particular voice may suggest a wealth of musical ideas to a composer's mind. In 1787, composer Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart buried a friend. He personally conducted the funeral service for a singer whom he had known for only 3 years, and yet of whom he was remarkably fond. And it was this vocalist whose voice had inspired Mozart in the composition of various works, including some of his most prominent works. The funeral was a touching experience, utterly unprecedented in the life of the composer. It was well intended. There was a long funeral procession of veiled mourners, the grief of whom was mostly in deference to Mozart's own grief. There was much singing of hymns, and finally at the graveside, Mozart himself, choking back tears, stepped forward and read aloud a poem which he, a composer of music, had written as a eulogy to his dearly departed friend. Well, the unabashed affection emerging from that poem arched eyebrows then and continues to perplex some biographers. But all of the emotion was there, and it's preserved in a manuscript in the composer's own handwriting, dated June 4, 1787. In any case, that's how this apparently tender relationship ended more than 2 centuries ago. But this is the rest of the story. The two, composer and singer, met not in an opera house or a concert hall, but in an unpretentious little shop in Vienna. For years, it was said that upon their meeting, Mozart was reminded of a tune from a composition on which he was then working. He hummed or whistled or sang it to the vocalist, and when the latter then sang it back to Mozart, he, the composer, was sufficiently excited to propose an association between the two, and for 3 years this association flourished. Now it may be told that according to more careful research into the life of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, the friend whose voice so flattered Mozart's music, may have been more than indirectly inspirational. In fact, the evidence suggests that upon that first meeting of composer and performer, it was not the composer who imparted an original melody to the singer. It was the other way around. Interestingly, that same tune would first be expressed not in a vocal work, but in one of Mozart's piano concerti. And it may be one of many melodies born in the mind of this singer and subsequently penned by Mozart. There's evidence for that as well. I feel certain that you have heard that first tune. It's the one from Mozart's G major piano concerto, K453. If you haven't heard it in a movie score, then surely on the radio or as background in a restaurant. And yet, even if you've never heard that melody in your life, you may recognize it upon first encounter, simply because it sounds so very much like something Mozart's friend would have composed and did. Did I mention when Vienna notables gathered in June of 1787 for that funeral over which the renowned composer presided, and for which he had written a very special farewell poem, they, the mourners, were more than saying goodbye to the composer's friend and associate. They were bidding farewell to a musical genius in his own right, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's pet starling. And now you know the rest of the story.
Protecting what matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. This hour's guest is one of my favorites, really, Professor Leo Hanian. He's a professor of macroeconomics at UCLA and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. We're going to talk about the upcoming changes at the Federal Reserve and how they may impact your business, impacts of inflation, tariffs, the One Big Beautiful Bill or Act, I guess it should be called right now, AI, and all of the other economic news out there that is fit to chat about. And Lee has also done some recent research and made some very interesting comments about the Palisades fire and how it could have been prevented at nearly no cost. So, Lee, please, welcome back to Protecting What Matters.
Yeah, hi, Barry. Good to be with you.
Thank you again. And so, folks, you can call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So let's just go right into our chat here, Lee. When we listen to the news and look at the polls, you know, we hear pundits of every type talking about the economy, consumer anxiety, confidence, you know, or lack of confidence, really, and the impacts of the various economic influences on our lives. So I'd like to take a good portion of today's PWM to get your perspectives on some of these matters. You know, the term we hear a lot as we about in economics, and especially now as it pertains to the One Big Beautiful Act, the new tax bill that, you know, is going to be expanding tax cuts for a lot of people. We hear the term supply side economics. What does that really mean, and how does this differ from the federal government directly throwing money into the economy in various different ways?
Yeah, so the term supply-side economics has been around for a long, long time. It goes back to the Reagan years, you know, with his election in 1980. And his idea, which at that time was considered radical, is that the way to promote prosperity within the United States was to reduce business costs, to reduce taxes, to increase affordability, and to spur efficiency and productivity growth and incentives for businesses to create jobs. And, you know, for those people who are old enough, you know, you'll remember Reagan implementing substantial tax cuts in the early 1980s, and the 1980s was a decade of substantially rising prosperity for the United States. I mentioned that it was considered radical at that time because the standard mantra within Washington is that, oh, well, you know, the way to kind of manage the economy was to spend more money from Washington. So take money out of people's pocketbooks, and then Washington would spend it directly.
Keynesian economics, correct?
That was called Keynesian economics at that time. And the success within the U.S. and the success within the U.K., which the prime minister in the U.K. at that time was Margaret Thatcher. She and Reagan were good friends. She implemented very similar policies. And the U.K. also grew substantially. They had even more onerous taxes and regulations than the United States, and they were a success story. So now, in my opinion, kind of all economics is supply side economics. There's a recent book out by a New York Times columnist, Ezra Klein. It's called Abundance, and it's very popular within Democratic Party circles. And what he essentially discovered or rediscovered, the idea has been around for a long time, is that what is holding back the Democratic Party, particularly from last year's election, is not emphasizing the importance of expanding opportunity, expanding job creation, expanding efficiency, and expanding affordability. So it really is in my opinion, it's kind of really the only game in town now. Government's role is to be a partner, a productive partner, with the private sector. They work hand in hand. There's important infrastructure investments that federal, state, and local governments make. They're central to the private sector being able to operate as well as they can. And we used to have very, very productive government and private sector relationships. Again, this is before my time, but Eisenhower's National Highway Project was a huge, just enormously important to make the U.S. an even higher performing economy, to increase efficiency and productivity. That's the way we used to think about government and the private sector. But over time, you know, in certain political circles, that view has changed. And when the private sector and the public sector aren't cooperative, aren't working hand in hand, we don't get good outcomes.
So one of the things, and this is getting a little bit off, you know, the main topic here, but you know, I've been involved for many, many years in, you know, health care reform debates and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things we used to say many years ago back in the 90s was that when government is too intrusive and tries to take over a system, it crowds out private innovation and again, private spending. So between regulation and the government spending a whole lot of money on things directly, they really put their thumb on the scale in a very, very negative way, don't they?
Yes. You know, Milton Friedman, who is one of the greatest economists of the 20th century, he had a saying that was very similar to what you noted, Barry. He used to say, when government starts doing what they shouldn't do, they stop doing what they should do. Mm-hmm. And I think that is that's a very important lesson for all of us to be aware of. But there's an awful lot of political groups who believe government is more government is the answer. And we only have to go back in time, not even 30 years. To Bill Clinton, Democrat. Bill Clinton's, I believe it was his 1996 State of the Union address, where he declared the era of big government is over. He talked very positively about increasing freedoms, particularly things like school choice. He talked about welfare to work reforms. These are all ideas that I think in today's Democratic Party, just not even 30 years later, would be anathema within some of the Democratic Party.
Well, let's move, you know, and again, going back, just the big benefit of tax cuts for individuals and businesses and all that they discovered, you know, the big thought was, well, when you cut taxes, then you're going to reduce revenues to the government. But in fact, revenues go up when you cut people's taxes. Why is that?
Well, you know, they certainly can. I wouldn't say that that every tax cut will lead to higher revenue, but it was certainly the case. For example, when Reagan implemented those big tax cuts in the 1980s, revenues rose substantially. Mm-hmm. And you know, the idea is that when you give the private sector more resources, businesses create jobs. Job creation leads to new incomes, which leads to new income taxes. Businesses make investments in new plant and equipment. That leads to higher revenues for those who produce computers and buildings and tool and die machines. And, you know, it goes on and on. The government is just not a very, irrespective of one's political leanings, the government just is not a very efficient spender of money.
Right.
A lot of it seems a black hole. And at the end of the day, it's because governments don't have a profit motive that governs and guards the bottom line. There's really no incentives in government to save money. And so as a consequence, we just see a lot of money going down a black hole and limited impact of that spending in some cases.
Well, and again, the other incentive is some parties, some politicians, and it goes probably cuts both ways, but will use the government money to buy votes from people, and then it becomes a fraud issue, and as we're seeing in Minnesota right now, and that whole story that's being uncovered. But that's probably time for another another show. But let's go back to the tax bill real quick. It's a supply side tax cut. So in your opinion, do you see the extensions of the 2017 Tax and Job Act and then the enhancements of the OBBA playing out? How do you see it playing out in 2026? Do you think some of this anxiety that's out there will be relieved for people by then?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of good parts to the OBB. It made permanent some of the tax cuts that were enacted. I believe that was in 2017. And, the standard view within economics is that capital income, whether that's dividends, whether it's rental payments, whether it's bank interest on your account, whether it's corporate profits, those should be taxed at a rate very close to zero.
Mm-hmm.
That's the standard view in economics. And the simple reason is because if you tax capital and investments at a high rate, you're introducing a distortion between the economy today and the economy in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So we tend to prefer low tax rates on capital income. So I think that was I think that's a great part of OBB. When that was first done in Trump's first administration, we had a higher corporate tax rate than Europe. And there's just no, and I think everyone who sensibly thought about this on the right and the left in Washington, in the Senate, in the House, knew that we had to have a synchronized tax rate with Europe, because otherwise there are these incentives for corporations to park a lot of money, across the pond. And so that was very important to implement that. Having I think it was a 35% corporate tax rate. On gross terms, that was a big mistake in my opinion. So I'm glad we made that permanent. There's other aspects to the one big beautiful bill. There's a permanent increase in the child tax credit. There's benefits for seniors. There is now what's been very very. Reactionary on the Democrat side is reducing social support service payments, and we just saw that with the shutdown with SNAP. Barry, you a moment ago you alluded to fraud that has been existing in various types of transfer and welfare programs. And I think what is interesting about all of this is that we never would have known. Had we not, it's never good to go through a government shutdown, but as we went through that and as people started digging through SNAP, it became much clearer that there's more fraud within that program than I think we ever expected. And I think perhaps the president and or people around him, I think they knew that this was going to get exposed.
Hmm.
I think the downside of the one of OBB is that we continue to look at federal government budget deficits into the future.
Mm-hmm.
And my view is that we should, during peacetime, during normal times of the economy, when we're not at war, when we don't face some type of crisis, we should run close to a balanced budget. That's my view. But we're going to be running into problems with that in the future. So that's my my primary concern about this.
So I'm guessing, I'm not in favor of rebates to people for these tariffs, and that's another topic we hopefully will get to. But yeah, I mean, to me, that money should, if we're bringing in all this tax revenue from tariffs, it ought to go to paying down the deficit and balancing the budget, kind of thing. Would you be on that side of the fence too?
Yes. The challenge that we face is that for people born in the baby boom generation, which was late 40s through the mid 60s, is that we're going to be getting a lot of retirements. We're getting a lot of retirements now. We're going to get more retirements in coming years, and that's going to put increased demand on Social Security and Medicare. And we have trust funds for those programs, but those trust funds are seriously underfunded. One thing about President Reagan, again, we're going back a long time, but I think it's important whether a person's on the left or the right. Reagan understood that at that time, back in the 1980s, he understood that they needed to modify Social Security because people were living much, much longer than was ever considered. You go back to 1939 and FDR, and very few people live past the age of 65.
So, right.
Social Security was put in place purely as an insurance program. The idea was, hey, if you got to the age of 65 in the year 1939, that was unusual. We want to make sure you have the resources to be able to support yourself because you're probably not going to be able to work. Lifespans have increased substantially. Yep. So Reagan dealt with that, at least partially in the 1980s, but we need to deal with that now, within the coming years.
Well, yeah, the entitlements are a big problem, and Social Security. Let's shift gears real quickly before the break. One of the things that's really creating a lot of anxiety amongst consumers is persistent inflation. And even though the inflation rate has been reduced by, from 9%+ due to the Inflation Reduction Act of the Biden era, and also, what was the other one, the American Rescue Plan, because they pumped so much money into the system. The question is, even though it's come down significantly, does inflation doesn't really ever go away? And do we need to have a recession or a depression to wring inflation out of the system?
We had huge bursts of inflation in 2021, 2022, when the CPI was running, I think, as high as 9%. Mm-hmm. And as you noted, in my opinion, a lot of that was due to those enormous federal deficit spending plans, the Inflation Reduction Act and the American Rescue Plan. And those were really political. Those were political programs. When Biden and Harris took office in January of 2021, I believe the unemployment rate had fallen to, I think, around 6%, which is about the post-World War II average. There was no real reason to do that, whatever kind of economist you are. So that was, I think, an awful lot of soft money that was being paid to politically important organizations and constituents. We don't need a recession or anything like that to get inflation under control. We need the public to understand that the Federal Reserve is really committed to having low inflation, low and stable inflation, like we did for a long, long time. But I think the Federal Reserve lost sight of what they were doing.
Well, that is a great segue to what we're going to be talking about on the other side of the break, which is the Federal Reserve and the changes are going to be happening there after the first of the year. So, Lee, I'm going to put you on hold. And, folks, we will be right back with Lee Ohanian, Professor of Macroeconomics. So stand by.
Ace Auto Care in Atascadero, the best price and service on brakes, tires, smog checks, oil changes, and more. Ace Auto Care, all your vehicle needs, everything you want.
News, I'm Tom Graham. The Trump administration says deadly strikes on suspected drug trafficking boats will continue in the Caribbean.
We've only just begun striking narco boats and putting narco terrorists at the bottom of the ocean because they've been poisoning the American people.
Secretary of War Pete Hegseth speaking during a White House cabinet meeting today. There have been bipartisan calls in Congress for an investigation over a double strike launched against a vessel from Venezuela. An Afghan national came to the U.S. in 2021 has pleaded not guilty following last week's shooting of two National Guard troops in Washington. U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro.
This is an individual about whom we don't know a lot, but we will. Trust me.
One Guard member was killed. Another remains in critical condition. America is listening to Fox News.
Let's be honest, everyone hates putting up Christmas lights, so why not just skip it this year? The truth is, it's not about the lights. It's about creating the memories. It's about seeing the kids' faces light up and not spending all day hanging up lights. I'm Aaron King, the owner of Slow Holiday Lights. We handle everything you need to make this holiday season the most memorable yet. We design, install, maintain, and store the beautiful Christmas lights so you don't have to lift a finger. No ladders to fall off of, no tangled lights to mess with, no stress, period. Look us up at slowholidaylights.com.
Well, Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Professor of Macroeconomics, Lee Ohanian, at UCLA, and the Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. You can call or text in with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Lee, one more question on inflation, and you don't have to take a whole lot of time on this. How do you see the tariff regime that we're now under from the Trump administration? How do you see this impacting inflation issues? I mean, is it significant? Is it meaningful? What's your take on that?
Yeah, so, thus far, some goods have been particularly hit, cars, furniture, apparel, electronics, and coffee are all up. Some firms are eating the increases for the time being. I think the issue is going to be whether the tariffs are going to continue for a much longer period. If they do, then we could see some additional inflation because businesses can only hold off on those price increases for only a short period of time. So we'll have to wait and see.
Okay. All right. Let's shift to the Federal Reserve. And I know, I believe you have been an advisor to one of the Federal Reserve banks or more, the regional banks over the years. And could you explain, in basic terms, what is the actual role of the Federal Reserve in our economy?
Sure. Yeah. The Fed's been around since 1914. It's a central bank, which means it has a number of functions, including supervision of banks, overall assessment and input into the country's financial system to make sure that's functioning and working efficiently. They have a responsibility to manage the money supply, and they ultimately have a mandate to produce low inflation. So they're an enormously important institution within the United States. There's always a lot of debate about what the Fed will do, what they should do, mistakes they have made. But, it's interesting, Barry, before the Fed existed, we, on average, the U.S. had about zero inflation. since they came in about 1914, I think a dollar today would be worth something like 4 cents back in 1914. That's just another way of saying we've had an awful lot of inflation on average since the Fed came into existence.
So that's not a very good report card, really. Well, yeah, and just from a historical perspective, I mean, I thought I read somewhere was that the Federal Reserve was really the big industrial magnates like J.P. Morgan and all those guys got tired of bailing out the federal government for when they would go into a recession or a depression, and especially during the Industrial Revolution. Was that part of the idea that the industrialists wanted to get out of it and let the government handle this in some fashion?
Well, yeah, the idea is that back in the day we used to have these panics, for people who've watched the movie, the old movie with Jimmy Stewart, It's a Wonderful Life. People run a bank. The bank gets financially unstable. The bank fails. The idea was that there should be a lender of last resort. And you're right. J.P. Morgan covered that back in, the Panic of 1896. But the idea was there should be a public functioning central bank that can backstop the U.S. financial system, including banks that might get in trouble for no fault of themselves. So that was the idea that led to the development of the Fed in 1913-1914.
So what role does the Fed currently play? We could probably talk all day about the last 20 years of Fed policy and since the great meltdown of 2007-2008, but that's probably a whole show to talk, we could take up. But the Fed is a big influencer though on interest rates. So what role do they play in that? And then with Jerome Powell terming out here in May, what look into your crystal ball and tell us what you're thinking about what you're anticipating may happen.
Sure. Yeah. So the Fed has a target for what's called the federal funds rate, and that's just a fancy word for the interest rate that's charged on overnight lending. There's an awful lot of money that transfers on overnight borrowing and lending. So the Fed has a target for that, and then they implement monetary policy to try to achieve that target. A few years ago, the interest rates were remarkably low. In fact, I refinanced our home with a 30-year jumbo mortgage. We're here in California, so it's a jumbo mortgage at 2.5%, no points, no fees for 30 years. And when I told my wife this, she said, "Well, do you really think it's a good idea?" And I said, "Honey, I wouldn't lend myself money for 30 years at 5% because inflation's coming." And then, we saw inflation. So the Fed is trying to produce lower inflation by raising interest rates. I have a different perspective. I think if we reduced interest rates somewhat right now, I think that would facilitate lower inflation. And again, it's hard to say how much tariffs are weighing on this, but we're around 3% and the target's 2%. So the target's in sight. We can definitely implement it. The president has been unhappy with Jerome Powell. It's interesting that the president appointed Jerome Powell. Powell is, in my opinion, he was never an ideal choice because, like any other business, you have to be an expert in what you're doing. And Powell was, he was a Wall Street guy. I think he was a Goldman guy. So he knew an awful lot about capital markets. But to really do that job, you need to be a PhD economist with a specialty in that area. Just like if you're going to manage a bunch of brain surgeons, you have to be a brain surgeon. So Powell's term is up, early next year. The president has already indicated he's not going to reappoint him. The leading candidates for that is a fellow named Kevin Hassett. He's a PhD economist, I think very, very good economist, in my opinion. He's worked with the president for a long time. I suspect he's the leading candidate. There's another fellow named Kevin Warsh. He was on the board of governors of the Federal Reserve some years ago. Good guy, not a PhD economist, and I'm trying to think who else is among that group. There's a fellow named Chris Waller who's currently on the board of governors, so he is a highly placed executive within the Fed. I know Chris well, good guy, PhD economist, very, very qualified. I suspect Trump is going to pick Hassett. He knows him very well. I think he trusts him. I don't know if Hassett will do everything the president wants. I personally would be very happy if Hassett was picked. It would be very different for the Fed because you'll be getting someone who knows an awful lot about the ins and outs of monetary policy. So that's what I expect to see early next year.
And then, do you see an acceleration in the drop? I mean, we focus on, what is it, the prime rate. And is that the rate that the Fed's charging for this overnight lending?
Well, the federal funds rate is okay. What they charge on overnight.
Okay.
No worries. I suspect that's going to come down. I believe it would with Hassett. He is his own guy. I think the good thing about Hassett is that the president trusts him, he respects him, and I think he will listen to him. So a big issue with the president is whether he believes in his mind if you're legitimate and if he should listen to you, even if you have a different opinion than him, and he will listen. So I think there's three very good candidates on the table, and I think it's unfortunate what happened with Powell. He was never, in my opinion, the best candidate, but in any case, we'll have some new leadership next year.
I'm pretty impressed with Bessent. He seems like, he's on top of everything. And, obviously he gets along with the president. There must be a ton of interface between the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve, even though they're supposed to be, arm's length organizations, right? But that's an important relationship, too, between those two, government entities to manage the economy. Isn't that true?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, there's a delicate dance. The Fed is supposed to be independent, and the idea being that you don't want politicians, twisting their arm and necessarily doing what politicians want that might benefit the politician, but that harms the public. We've seen that in many countries, for example, in Turkey. Turkey has run through one central bank governor after another because those governors would refuse to implement what President Erdogan wanted. I've known some of those guys. They were good economists, and they were kind of run out because they wouldn't do what politicians wanted. But at the same time, Barry, as you noted, the Fed has to coordinate and cooperate with the Treasury because obviously the Treasury is issuing, all that debt that is out there, a lot of it which came from the Biden administration, some of it which came from Trump during COVID, some of which came from Obama during the financial meltdown of 2008-09. They absolutely have to cooperate. What you want is that they have a very close, productive, cooperative working relationship. They're on the same page. But the Fed is not feeling undue political influence to sort of do what Washington wants, which might be not what would be good for the rest of the country.
And real quickly, I sent you an article, I don't know if you saw it, by Mohammed El Aryan, who's a professor of economics, and he's always on Varney and that kind of stuff, and the business shows. He's an economist, and he wrote this article here about that there are many structural changes that should be happening within the Fed to make it better for more efficient. I don't know if you had a chance to read that or saw that, but I mean, is there any major other changes that you think should be happening at the Fed that they should be looking at?
Well, so one issue that came up is just how many people do you need within the Federal Reserve System to run it, particularly with developments in information technology, particularly artificial intelligence. As you noted, I've advised several regional Feds. I've also been a visiting scholar at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington. I've advised some European central banks. I don't know. I know a lot about their economic research departments. I don't know as much about their operating divisions. But I suspect that, like any other government entity, there's a lot of stasis, and there are probably a lot of efficiency reforms one can implement in those structures. My understanding is the New York Fed president has told their employees that they probably would be reducing staff in some operational categories, probably not in economic research. So for those PhD economists out there, I don't think they're going to be losing jobs, but some of the operational people might.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of losing jobs, let's talk about artificial intelligence. And obviously, this is something that's happening whether we like it or not, so we better figure out how to do it right. So one of the things that I wanted to start with was, how do you compare the innovations of artificial intelligence compared to other big changes in our economies over the decades, over really the centuries, going from an agrarian, society, at the time of the revolution to the industrial revolution, automobiles getting rid of, the need for buggy whips, as it were. So, I mean, how do you view the whole, from a historical and just a big picture perspective, how does this compare to other major, changes we've had in our world, in our economy?
Yeah, that's the question that people should be asking, the question you just asked, but media never really asked that question. Media treats AI like it's this asteroid that landed in the middle of nowhere. But as you noted, our history has been one of essentially labor-saving technological change. You mentioned that back in the day, about half of our workforce was employed on farms. We needed half. Every other person had to produce food to keep the country fed. Today, I believe it's less than 1%. Mm-hmm. And that's because of enormous technological innovations. And the good news is that that releases a lot of human resources to work in other areas that we value. You can go back in time. There used to be occupations such as before alarm clocks. People would get hired and they would throw a rock on your window to wake you up. there's always we used to have telephone operators. We don't have those anymore. So the issue is that we have always, if you think about the human brain, just what a remarkable organ, what remarkable creativity and innovation and imagination we all have within our brains. And we've always, from Cro-Magnon, man, we figured out how to do things that make us more productive and that allow us to use time in different ways. I believe that AI is going to be something very similar. The challenge with AI is going to be every technological change takes away jobs. So that guy that used to throw pebbles on somebody's window, they lost their job when the alarm clock came along. The issue becomes people have to be sufficiently flexible and have enough skills to be able to make changes. And we've been seeing that forever. I think that process is not always smooth. For somebody who is 61 or 62 years old, losing their job to AI is going to be a hard thing.
Yeah.
For somebody who is 30 years old and they lose their job, but if they have a good education and they have a set of skills, they're going to be able to retool and they may have a much better future because of AI. And when you think about what AI might do in government, we just think about how many people are in the DMV and Medi-Cal system, and you just think about the opportunities for AI within government, and I just think we could have a huge efficiency boom in that case. I use AI; it makes me a lot more productive. Although I got to be careful because sometimes it makes stuff up.
Yes,
but we've always been able to adapt. I think the issue that the media is not focusing on is just how far our public K-12 education quality has declined, because to use new technologies, you have to be able to be creative and imaginative. You have to think logically. You have to be able to abstract a little bit sometimes. You have to be able to figure stuff out. And our K-12 education system, which used to be the leader in the world not all that long ago, is now in a lot of school districts in California. Just, I hate to say it, but it's just awful.
Yep.
We're producing kids that, there's just a report out of UCSD, UC San Diego, which was, I think, ranked the fifth best public university in the country. There's something like 13 or 14% of their students need remedial math, including remediation back to the third grade. And these are kids who are going to UC San Diego.
How the heck they're getting in?
Exactly. How are they getting in? So the UC system dropped standardized tests a few years ago.
Hmm.
If they hadn't, those deficiencies would show up on the math SAT.
So how do you think, real quick, because we got like a minute left in the segment, how do you think AI will, because you hear you're in the university system, how will AI disrupt education and jobs in the future?
I think it could be wonderful within the educational sphere. I think it can be a great teaching tool. But on the other hand, it's going to require, I think, a much more skilled teaching force than we have right now, because a lot of those teachers who are teaching our kids, they may as well have very deficient technical and mathematical skills. So I think we're going to have to figure that out. Again, that's a topic for another time,
because
it involves teachers' unions and so forth. But difficult to predict, but there's a potential for, I think, just great things for our society.
Schumpeter? I think I'm pronouncing that right. Used to talk about creative destruction. Yeah. And we're definitely there, right? So,
that's how it grows.
Well, when we return, folks, we're going to ask Lee to change gears and talk a little bit about the fires down in Los Angeles, which I believe is where you live, Lee. And so you have a bird's eye view, and you've done a lot of research on that. So I'm going to put you on hold, And folks, we will be right back in about 3 minutes. So stand by.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL is brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
I'm Liz Klayman, and this is the Fox Business Report.
The major average is ending higher and recouping some of the previous session's losses, with the NASDAQ recovering all of Monday's losses. Tech and industrials gained while healthcare and energy lagged. The Magnificent Seven big tech companies were mostly higher. Shares of Apple rose over 1% and hitting an all-time high for its sixth straight record close. Shares of Boeing taking off and rising 10% after its CFO offered an optimistic outlook for next year. While speaking at a conference today, he said that the plane maker expects high deliveries for the 737 and 787 in 2026 and expects to grow cash flow next year. The Dow winners, Boeing, Caterpillar, and Goldman Sachs. The Dow decliners, Home Depot, Sherwin-Williams, and IBM. The Dow up 185 points. The NASDAQ higher by 138. S&P 500 up 17. That's your Fox Business Report. I'm Pilar Rybarski, invested in you.
I'm alpine skier Michaela Schifrin. I've won the most World Cup ski races in history. But what does success mean to me? Success means discipline. It's teamwork. It's the drive and passion inside of us, and it's why Stifel is one of the fastest growing global wealth management firms in the country. If you're looking for success, surround yourself with the people who will get you there. If you're an advisor or investor, choose Stifel, where success meets success.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Past performance is no indication of future results. Investing involves risk. Consult a financial advisor before making any investment decision.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
Do you use propane for your home or business? Family-owned and operated, Delta Liquid Energy has provided local area residents with dependable and courteous propane service since 1936. From home heating and cooking to powering your irrigation engine pump or forklift, propane can do it all. Don't forget their location. Paso Robles refills propane bottles of all sizes Monday through Friday and has a dump station for your RV. Learn more. Call Delta Liquid Energy, 805-239-0616, or go online, DeltaLiquidEnergy.com.
The city of Atascadero kicks off their holiday season with the Light Up the Downtown's Garden Lights and Winter Nights, making the Sunken Gardens area sparkle. This Friday, from 5:30 to 8 p.m., enjoy community entertainment, Santa, complimentary horse-drawn hay rides, hot chocolate, and more. The event begins in the Sunken Gardens and continues throughout the downtown with a holiday sip and shop. Shops will be open late, and wine and beer tastings will be available from participating merchants. For more info, go to visitatascadero.com.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Professor of Macroeconomics, Leo Hanian. He's at UCLA, and he's also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. Next week's show is going to feature Steve Odom of Spartan Tactical, and we're going to be talking to him about his work with police and other first responders in dealing with PTSD and the anxiety that comes from their jobs. And then we'll also have Greg Haskin, who is the Director of Government Affairs for CoLab. We're going to do a year in review and what he expects to see happening in 2026 in our lovely county of San Luis Obispo. So Lee, I do believe you live down, you weren't in the Palisades for the fire, were you? Or do you live just adjacent to that kind of area? Lee?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Barry.
It's okay.
My family and I used to live in the Palisades. We lived in two homes. One was completely burned to the ground, and the other was only about half a mile from where the fire started. Mm-hmm. So I know the area well. We moved away from there a few years ago. But just what we still have a lot of friends there, many of whom lost their homes. I mean, their lives have just been turned upside down and devastated. know, several people lost their lives. Just enormous economic and human damage. Just what a tragedy.
Right. And yeah, it is. And I mean, having grown up in the San Fernando Valley, but also gone to UCLA myself and at USC and all that kind of stuff. I mean, we hung out in the Palisades all the time. It was a true tragedy. You wrote a couple of articles, blogs, I guess, in your your blog on California on Your Mind at the Hoover Institution. And you did one early on, but the one that you wrote recently, I believe, November 7th, it looks like. The title is enticing. It's a review of the after-action report from the L.A. Fire Department. The title of the article is, Could the Palisades Fire Have Been Prevented, Perhaps at a Cost of Nearly Zero? So in the last few minutes we have left, can you give us a quick summary of what your findings were and your thoughts are?
Yeah, so the, if any of your listeners subscribe to the L.A. Times has a series of articles in which they have reported that there was a small brush fire on New Year's Eve in the Palisades. They've reported that fire was never fully extinguished, that it smoldered. There is some video evidence of that. There is a whistleblower within the L.A. Fire Department that has been discussing that. The Times acquired some text messages from firefighters who said we shouldn't leave, fire is still hot. Federal investigators have concluded that fire called the Lackman Fire reignited and became the Palisades Fire. Infrared imaging was never used on that fire to highlight hotspots. There are now lawsuits against the state of California and also the city of Los Angeles. I think they're basically about negligence, that if that fire had been fully contained, the Palisades Fire would never have started, and we never would have had that tragedy. The firefighters were up there. They were concerned that the fire wasn't extinguished, and their battalion command told them to come home. So those lawsuits are going on in court right now, and we will see how that proceeds. But if this whistleblower and text messages, if all of that is accurate, then indeed the city of L.A. really dropped the ball.
So can you give us kind of an update on we're hearing reports that, you know, rebuilding is moving at a glacial pace up there, and that, you know, between the Coastal Commission and all the other regulatory stuff, it's never going to be the same in the Palisades, is it?
Yeah, it has such a special feel to it. Obviously, you know, gorgeous. I was there recently. There is some rebuilding going on. I don't believe any houses that were destroyed have been rebuilt. There was one rebuild that Mayor Karen Bass was celebrating, but that was a home that was already destined to be rebuilt. Permits had been taken out earlier than that. So she celebrated that, but then she walked that back because it wasn't a home that the ones we're talking about. So no, I don't think it'll ever be the same. It looks like it's going to take years. And again, when we talk about AI, just imagine how permitting processes could be accelerated if AI was being used to evaluate building plans and permits instead of human eyes that are right now, they're overwhelmed with permits, and there's only so many of these people that are doing that, and there's a big backlog. And, you know, in the area I lived, almost the entire thing was totally devastated, and you just about every fourth lot has a for sale sign. And there's almost no action in the area where I used to live. If people are familiar with that area off of PCH, it's called Sunset Mesa, right above the original Getty Villa. Almost all the homes there are gone, and hardly any rebuilding.
Is it? Well, I was going to ask you one more question, but I hear the bumper music. Lise, what's the best way for people to follow your writings and your work?
Yeah, I'm at the Hoover Institution. I write a piece called California on Your Mind. It appears twice a month every other week.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I know how busy you are, and I really appreciate you coming on air with me. And have a great holiday season and Happy New Year.
Happy holidays to you and yours, Barry.
All right. Folks, I'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us.
Join us next Tuesday for Protect What Matters the Most with Barry Fisher. Send your questions and show topic ideas to barry@blazinbear.com. AM 1230 KPRL, 99.3 FM, KPRL.com, Paso Robles, Atascadero, Templeton.